AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at rubrik.com. That's rubrik.com.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Hello, I'm Jim Cornell, and this is the WalkingPost.com podcast. WalkingPost.com is the news website dedicated to walking, with all the latest on gear, books, health, trails, festivals, events, fitness, and more. This podcast is number 37, and it's going out on December the 5th. Scarily close to Christmas here in the UK, and the panic buying has begun, and the weather is still wet. I went to an event on Wednesday and had to decide between bus or train. Well, I guess car was another option, but that's the most expensive when you include parking. So I went with train, only to discover on the way back that there was a points failure, so I had to get the bus back from Glasgow anyway. Which now also means claiming for the train ticket. Nothing straightforward these days. Let's take a quick look at December the 5th. It's International Volunteer Day, it's Blue Jeans Day, and it's Communicate With Your Kids Day. I'd be happy to if someone could tell them that it's Communicate With Your Parents Day as well. I'm sure that a lot of people can relate to, how was school? Fine. Anything interesting? No. And it's Father's Day as well. Well, it is in Thailand. It's the day that the first bit of the motorway opened in the UK, and no doubt 2 days later it was closed for roadworks. It's also the birthday of General Custer and Little Richard. Last time we had a conversation about a book being published in January through Brat Guides, one of the slow travel series, and it's one about the Isle of Man, and it's written by Emma Craig. This week we have a conversation with another author, Linda Orkeson McGurk. And we do cover her two books, but we also chatted about getting outdoors and walking in Sweden, which probably has the best right to roam legislation out there, even more so than here in Scotland. But before we do get going, if you have news, guest ideas, or even subjects to cover, or comments, or if you want to advertise, please do get in touch via walkingpost.com or just email me at jim@walkingpost.com. Okay, let's go through some of the headlines of the news articles you may have missed that we had on walkingpost.com this past week. And there was quite a lot, which is good news. A walking project has opened up discussions around mental health. In some countries, not the UK sadly, all trails can be used now in ChatGPT, and 62,000 acres of South Carolina forest, including trails, has been protected. Aurora has added to its heated down jackets collection. Salt Lake County in Utah is boosting its Bonneville Shoreline Trail. And in the UK, national parks are unlocking access to health and nature through active travel. The King Charles III Cedar Trail in Lebanon has been inaugurated, and Joma, or Joma if you're in Spain where the brand is from, has launched its Our Trail Nature rain jacket. The Canadian government and Thunder Bay in Ontario have bridged the city's trail network with bridges, and tickets are now available for Eurorando 2026. And you can read all of these and more at walkingpost.com.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
All right, let's get to this week's conversation. I saw not too long ago that there were discussions taking place about whether or not to charge hikers on a very popular trail in Italy. And because of that, I was in two minds. Is it a good thing because it keeps things manageable and it helps with protection of the land? Or is it a bad thing? In Scotland, we do have the right to roam, although in some parts of the country you'd think that that didn't exist. Probably the most wide-ranging right to roam is in Sweden, so that gave us an opportunity to have a chat with Swedish-American author Linda Åkesson McGurk about, well, all kinds of things. The outdoors, her books, the right to roam, and charging for access to walk. All right, thanks so much for being with us today. And I wonder if maybe first you could introduce a little bit about yourself and your books.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, my name is Linda Åkesson McGurk, and I was born and raised in Sweden in a very sort of nature-rich culture. And then I moved to the U.S. when I was in my 20s, and I had two children there and quickly realized that Indiana, where I lived, was worlds apart from Sweden. And I noticed that people were mostly inside and didn't really connect with nature the way I was raised. And that sort of inspired me to get on a journey to get more people outside. So that's been my mission for the past 15 years, is to educate, engage, and inspire people to get outside and connect with nature. Both my books are about, the first one about there's no such thing as bad weather is about, it's a parenting memoir about getting kids outdoors to play. And the second one, The Open Air Life, is about the Nordic philosophy of friluftsliv, or the habit to connect with nature in everyday life. And after living in the U.S. for 15 years, I moved back to Sweden in 2018, and I live here now with my children and my husband. And I continue on this journey to get people outside.
The concept that we have in Scotland, I think, is taken from Scandinavia, the right to roam. How do you think that affects people going out into the wilds?
I think Sweden has the most extensive right to roam legislation in the world, actually, followed by Norway and then maybe Finland. And I'm not sure, but I know Scotland, like you said, has it too. I'm not sure how it compares. But so having grown up with that, I do think that it really has been, I think it's been an important factor in my life for connecting with nature and other people's as well. I think it's definitely really ingrained in our culture and makes us, I think, seek out nature closer to home because it's so easy to access. I mean, you can hike and walk anywhere pretty much, whether it's private or privately owned land or publicly owned land. It doesn't really matter whose name is on the property deed. You can go anywhere, and you can also pitch a tent as long as it's out of view of a person's home. Then you can stay for a couple of nights without asking permission. In Sweden, you're also allowed to have a small campfire. In Norway, it's a little different. It's restricted during half the year. And I think it helps, you know, having these everyday experiences and also growing up being educated about it. It's something that is taught in preschool here. It's like, okay, we have this right to roam, but it also comes with a set of responsibilities. So we don't litter, we don't make noise, we don't disturb wildlife and things like that. We get that. It's in our mother's milk almost. Even the youngest children know that. So I think that's really special, and it gives you a unique way to connect with nature. And I didn't even realize how unique it was until I moved to the U.S. and I realized it was completely different there. I was shocked to, you know, for a while I lived in Montana and we lived right next to a national forest, but I couldn't just get there easily. Like I had to ask the neighbor permission to cross their land to get to the forest. And at one point I accidentally ended up on a private road and I was apprehended by a person who was like really mad at me for being on their road. And in Sweden, like you can walk, like I said, you can walk anywhere. It made me scared almost to go certain places because I was worried I was going to end up on private land and, you know, unwittingly do make somebody mad and break the rules. So I think it is more difficult in a way, you know, in other countries that where you don't have the right to roam. And I think, unfortunately, I think the U.S. Constitution makes it hard to implement anything similar because you'd have to compensate the landowners and that it would get very expensive. But then again, they do have their national park system instead. And there is a lot of public land in the U.S., but it's just not as accessible in everyday life. So you have to find ways around it and connect with nature in local parks, for example. I mean, a lot of people live in cities now, so there's that. But I definitely came to appreciate the right to roam more after living abroad for 15 years.
Yeah. Do you think that plays a part in, I mean, you were talking about your philosophy of trying to get more people outside. Do you think that ease makes it the reason why? I mean, just when I was walking the Götaleden a couple of stages, I was just taken aback at the number of people using the exercise equipment that's along the routes and that were playing the games that they've put in the forest. It was remarkable. But do you think that that's because of that ease that people don't have to seek it out?
Yeah, I think so. And I think we're also very much raised with the notion that you go outside every day, regardless. I mean, we have that saying, there's no such thing as bad weather, only bad clothes. And we know it's instilled in us from childhood. I mean, even babies nap outside all year round and doctors recommend it. Preschool teachers take the kids outside for hours every day. And so we get into the habit early. And I think that's really important to start early, because then as you get into the teen years, you might drift away from nature for a few years, but then nature is always a place for you to come back to. And I think most people do. As you get into adulthood, you know that nature is always there for you in good times and in hard times. And I think a lot of Swedish people or Nordic people, we recognize that being in nature has so many benefits. You know, it's good for the body, it's good for the soul. We lean on nature in times of crisis, even. People who have, who get a cancer diagnosis or lose a child, studies show they turn to nature just as much as they turn to therapy, actually. So you could say it's a form of therapy, but honestly, I think it's just a way to come back to our origins because we have evolved in nature for millennia. So, you know, to me, it's not strange that people go out and turn to nature in their everyday life. It's part of our wiring and also the culture, of course, that we've been told over and over throughout childhood that it's good for us.
That freedom to roam anywhere that exists in very few, unfortunately, countries, there's kind of a freedom of that involves not having to pay for it. Do you think that, I mean, you go to the US and you've got to pay to get into a lot of parks, and do you think that is a deterrent as well?
Yeah, I think anytime you put a price on something, of course, it's going to make it less accessible to some people. Of course, I think that's definitely a factor. It is very easy and very accessible. I mean, and there are parks everywhere here too. So it makes it accessible, not just for people coming in their free time, but also for daycares, for example, or, you know, nursing homes, for whoever wants to use those public spaces, it is free. And I think that definitely makes them used more. And also the fact that they are close, because the farther away you have to go to get to a place where you're actually allowed to recreate, the bigger of a hurdle it's going to be. You know, getting into the car and driving for 4 hours, that's not going to be an option for some people. So that definitely limits access too. But when you have a right to roam, you automatically have more areas that can be used. So people also spread out more. You don't have everybody going to that one park where you're allowed to go. And that's also something I noticed in the US. I lived in Montana for a couple of years, and then we moved to Indiana. And in Montana, almost like 38% of the land is public, so where you can access it. Whereas in Indiana, it's only a little over 4%. And that was a drastic shift for me from being in a place where it was so easily accessible to where almost all land is private. And the default is that to keep out. There are no trespassing signs everywhere. And I had no choice but to get in the car and drive for, well, at least half an hour to get to a decent sized park. And I did have to pay a fee, not a high fee, but still a fee. So I think that that combination definitely makes it a little less accessible.
I guess the other side of that is that by paying for parks, you're helping to protect them, and also the service itself of park rangers and visitor centers and parking lots and that kind of thing. So I guess there is a need for that.
Well, I think you pay for it one way or another. We just pay for the maintenance through our taxes. And yeah, you can make the argument that you get more money for it by charging fees, which in the US, the park system is actually a huge, huge moneymaker. And yes, that is a positive if the money actually goes to the right thing, which is not guaranteed, I would say. I mean, we've seen recently there have been huge cuts in personnel and so on. So even though the park system in the U.S. is actually making money. But yeah, it gives you more opportunities to build big facilities and make bigger investments, of course.
Sure. And what do you think about, all the time now we're reading about places in Italy that are charging people to hike, and it's not just Italy, but more places are starting to say, well, we don't want the number of tourists that we're getting. How do you balance that?
Yeah. So, of course, my default as a person who spent years, encouraging people to get outside, I also recognize that there are places that are being loved to death. And I think there are places where some regulation is necessary. But I think there are different ways to go about it. I mean, yes, you can charge fees, or you can restrict it by numbers and do like either first come, first serve, where you have to pre-book, or you can do like a lottery, which is the case in some places in the US. But I think if you are gonna restrict it, and this may be an unpopular opinion, but I think that nature should be local and regionally based first, so that I think if you're going to charge the international visitors or whoever, I think I would see it a system based on like the distance traveled or something like that. So the farther you've traveled, the more you pay, I think, because if you've already paid for that trip to come over, then I think you can also, I don't think it's unreasonable that you also contribute to the maintenance and the longevity of that nature area and support that. I do think that our most important way to connect with nature is in our everyday life. So I do think it's crucial to the people who actually live in the area that they feel that it's sustainable to them, because they live there. They don't just fly in and stay for a week. They are the ones who have to live with the consequences of over-tourism. And yes, I mean, in some places, having an increase in visitors have also brought wonderful things in terms of economic development in areas that have been economically depressed, and that can be a positive, but it is about balance. And I could take, for example, Trolltunga in Norway, which is this rock formation that sort of sticks out like a tongue. It means troll's tongue in Norwegian. I write about it in my second book, how they went from just like under 1,000 visitors before Instagram launched some 15 years ago. And then today they are at 100,000 visitors per year almost. And they had a lot of growing pains in the beginning because it happened very fast. It happened over maybe not overnight, but from one year to another, where influencers were posting pictures from this iconic cliff and hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people started to see them and started to flock to this place in Norway. And there was a lot of controversy in the beginning, especially, going back and reading articles from that time where the Norwegian Outdoor Association, they were pushing for fees because they felt like, this place is getting overrun, it's out of control, all these tourists are coming, they're littering, there's a queue, like you have to stand and wait for like an hour and a half to get your picture taken. So they were actually pushing for fees, and that's pretty remarkable in a country with the right to roam too. But they just didn't feel like it was sustainable. But today, I think what they've done is they took a path of education instead. So now there is this big website with information, and they are like really trying to make sure that people are prepared when they come, that they dress right, because that's another thing they noticed. People were just hiking up there in shorts and t-shirt. This is a mountain area. I mean, this is wild nature, and people weren't prepared for it. So they are really trying to educate people so that they are prepared when they get there. They encourage people to go with guides. They also tell people what to expect, like the July and August are the busiest months. And I think, that it seems to, so far, it seems like it works for them, but they might still come to a point where they start charging a fee. And honestly, yeah, I wouldn't blame them.
You wonder if that makes any difference. And especially when you consider the ecological dangers of having so many people. I know there's always a big discussion here in the UK and in other countries of, should you pave a path so that people stick to it rather than have them just go all over the place and damage sensitive ecology.
Yeah, I would probably be in a team, not no pavement. But I think there are ways of making the trail impossible to miss. I mean, there are places in the Swedish mountains where they have brought in Sherpas from Nepal, and I think they've done that in Norway too, actually, to build stairs, for example, stepping stones. I mean, they're experts at that, and that's something that they do that using rocks that are found locally. And so I think, I mean, that's a sustainable way to do it. To asphalt a path to make it more accessible, no, I'm sorry. I think there are places where you can do that without making too much harm to nature, but at places like Trolltunga and the likes, I think that would be too much of an intrusion on the natural landscape, and it would take away from the beauty of it. And actually, I think it would actually contribute to the problem. I think places like that actually don't need to be more accessible because they're already being loved to death. In general, I would say I'm not really pro putting asphalt down in nature areas.
All right. And what about tourist taxes? Rather than saying it costs you, I don't know, 10 euros to walk on this path, a lot of places are implementing tourist taxes for the Airbnbs and the hotels where you pay an amount every night and that gets distributed?
Yeah, I think it's fair. The locals do take a lot of the pain. Yeah, they get some benefits, but with you mentioned Airbnb, we know locals have been outpriced of some areas because all the residents are turned into Airbnbs. I do think it's fair that tourists pay their fair share to ensure that they can have a sustainable development locally. But like I said earlier, though, I do think it's also important then that the local community has a say in how that money is distributed and spent, so that it is to the betterment of the community and that they actually get something out of it, so it doesn't just end up in an anonymous slush fund somewhere, but the money is actually used to improve conditions where it's needed.
Yeah, that's right. You need that transparency, otherwise it could just be used for filling in potholes. Or you were talking about the right to access in Sweden and in the Nordic countries. Do they, just thinking about Nova Scotia this year when they had all of these terrible forest fires and they basically banned everybody from hiking in the forest, would that happen where you are?
Not that I've seen. But it makes sense because the biggest risk factor for wildfires is, of course, humans. I mean, that is the most common way forest fires get started, is because of a stray ember from a campfire or somebody accidentally or purposely lights the place on fire. I haven't seen access being restricted, but we do have fire bans, campfire bans here. And that happens during dry years. We do see that quite a bit. So that's something to always, be on the lookout for. But the authorities are usually pretty good about informing people when a fire ban is in effect. And I think most people respect that. Like I said, I think it runs deep in our veins. We see ourselves as a nature-connected people, and I think that's really important that it becomes part of your identity, because you really have to be out there and connect with nature in order to develop an affinity towards nature. And that affinity, that's what's going to push you to protect nature as well, whether it's by following campfire bans or by making pro-environmental choices in your everyday life. I think it all starts with that connection. So that's like the very foundation. And then environmental education in early childhood, when you get that in there too, that's the combination that you need. You need to have the emotional attachment, and then you also need the educational part. And where those two meet, I think there can be some beautiful synergies. And you have a people who are, I think, more likely to act in a pro-environmental way. Having said that, there are exceptions here too. And it's definitely not like everybody in the Nordic countries behave like they should on the trail. I mean, we saw that during the COVID pandemic, for example, when the interest in friluftsliv and open air life just surged because there wasn't that much else to do. Everything else was closed. And so people just flocked to the mountains, and everybody was going to all of a sudden summit Mount Kebnekaise, which is the highest mountain in Sweden. Even though they didn't have any experience and didn't read up on how to do it beforehand. So they just went out and bought expensive equipment and went to the mountain. And then I don't know how many abandoned tents and, that the Outdoor Association had to pick up after that. But it was, I think that first COVID year, I think they collected over like 80 tents in just one short season that people had just up and left. And of course that was just part of the litter. I mean, there was all sorts of other litter too. So that's when we saw a disconnect. But I think that was also a wake-up call for the Outdoor Association. So I think they intensified efforts to educate people as well after that happened. But that was an extreme case where a lot of people who don't normally go hiking all of a sudden decided that they were gonna. So it was kind of it created a perfect storm for pollution and litter on the trails.
So I guess with everything then, pretty much, as you said, your books are about education probably is the key, not just at an early age, but throughout life, I guess.
Yeah, I try to inspire people, and usually that comes through the personal benefits. I try to show people, like when we go outside, like our cortisol levels drop, our heart rate goes down, like we feel relaxed and calm, and it's just so good for us. So that's why, I mean, that should be automatically, that should be the why, you know, why you go outside. But I think a lot of times the other part of this is forgotten, and that is that we need people to connect with nature because the planet actually needs it. I mean, we're at a pivotal time right now with so many challenges facing Earth, and if we don't have people who are out there and actually miss a forest when it's cut down, then I think we're going to be in big trouble. I mean, we need people to be out there and care about the natural world and act like they care. So that's the other part of my message. So it's partly about the personal benefits. We'd all be better off, our physical and mental health, if we spend more time outside, but we also need to be out there to feel moved to act on environmental issues facing the Earth today.
You've had those two books that did very well. Are you planning on more?
I hope so. Yes. I'm kind of in the early stages of planning a third book, but we'll see. Nothing for sure yet.
So another enjoyable conversation there. And if you would like to buy either of Linda's books, there's a link in the article that accompanies this podcast in some places. And you could also just do a Google or Amazon search for Linda McGurk. Or you could do a search for one of her books, which are called There's No Such Thing as Bad Weather and The Open Air Life. So we will leave it there for this week. If you do have news or suggestions for podcast guests, please do get in touch through jim@walkingpost.com. And as I always mention, I am always looking for guests, whether it's about a new trail, new equipment, a new book, or someone who has done an amazing walk somewhere. Not really much on the agenda this weekend other than avoiding the rain and maybe learning how to use our new video camera. And probably a bit of work too. So, I hope you enjoyed this week's WalkingPost.com podcast, and I hope you have a great week, hopefully with a walk somewhere, remembering there's no such thing as bad weather, as Linda told us. So, until next time, happy trails! Walking Post from WalkingPost.com is an Air Coastal Media Limited production.